Welcome to the Young Politico episode of Both Sides of the Aisle. My name is Matt Lusty in the political middle, and joining me today we have on the right, Eric Rowan. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you.
And on the left, Emily Hayes. Emily, how are you?
Great, thanks.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. We're excited to talk to you. We're going to start talking about some national stuff to get going. I want to start out talking about something that is a little bit interesting. And a couple of days ago, a report came out of Iowa saying that as they prepared for the Democratic primaries, they're like, man, we have too many candidates, right? Too many Democrats are running, right? And, you know, you've heard the rumors with on the Republican side, like, oh, is everyone going to get behind Donald Trump? There's kind of some frustration. Will there be somebody that challenges him? I, at the end of the day, think that people are going to get behind the president just because how do you take on the sitting incumbent? Even if you don't agree with them, just from logistics. But let's talk about Democrats right now, because
all right,
holy cow, there are a lot of Democrats. Emily, representing the left, what do you think? What are we going to do with all these folks?
You know, I have a hard time taking the Iowa Democrats' complaints, because in the state of Utah, we've had, I think we've had two candidates come through so far, and we have been ecstatic. We're looking forward to having more attention from our Democratic candidates this year in 2020, because we've had our primary date moved up. And so we're hoping to actually get a little bit of that attention that the Iowa folks are probably a little used to. I think we've got a great slate running, and I would take any opportunity to meet any of them if I was living in the state of Iowa.
Are you ready to give the Salt Lake County Dem Chair endorsement to any Democratic candidate yet?
You know, I'm actually constitutionally bound to not give an endorsement to
anyone. That's fantastic.
Yeah, I'm not allowed to give endorsement or material support to anyone before they're actually our nominee in order to remain neutral in these races. But, you know, I've got a couple that I like and hope to see make it through. It'll be interesting to see who all makes it onto the debate stage. It's made it a little hard for us logistically, because we've wanted to host some watch parties, and with multiple nights, it's a lot to take up. So I'm looking forward to having a more narrowed conversation in the future.
Yeah, Eric, let's go to you. Are you just hoping for like a battle royale from the Republican side? Is this going to be something that you're like watching closely and saying, okay, can we just get the worst person possible from the Democrat side?
You know, I honestly don't think it matters who we get from the Democratic side. I think Trump's going to win re-election.
Oh, okay. Why is that?
You know, I think you look at the numbers, you look at the economy, you look at the jobs, you look at kind of what he's done, and I'm still testing the temperature of the electorate throughout the United States. I just think he's got the support to pull it off.
He's made America great, huh? That's what you're saying. We're ready to go. Emily, let's get a response on that. What do you think? Do you think that Donald Trump is beatable? Because I felt from Democrats optimism. They're saying, you know what, this is a president that really isn't liked all that much. We can beat him, right? What do you think?
You know, I think that I think Democrats are going to take back the White House in 2020. Trump, while his favorability ratings have remained true among his core base, he has one of the highest unfavorability ratings of any president that's ever sat. He's in the middle of scandal. He's in the middle of all of these different proceedings in Congress. And our Democrats in Congress are going to continue to hold him accountable. So I think that we're going to see more come out of the Mueller report, more come out of all of the different obstruction coming out of his administration. I think that that's not going to be good for him going forward. I think we'll also remain to see what happens with the economy. You know, his actions with the Federal Reserve and other things that he's done recently, I don't think are very indicative of a level of maturity that we're used to seeing from a president and guidance on economic matters. And so we'll have to, it'll remain to be seen how that turns out.
You know, I'll completely agree that, yeah, there is a level of immaturity. He's not very well liked, generally speaking. We see a lot of issue, and I actually have a lot of issue with him when we talk about, like, the free market, for example, tariffs and stuff like that. I have major issue with some things that he's doing. And you're right, that we are early for the economy, but if you look at historically the way the economy shifts and moves, and then how that determines who gets elected in the general election of the presidency, I think I'm going to predict another Trump re-election, especially if Biden wins the nomination from the Democrats.
Interesting. So I don't want to spend too long on this topic, so I want to move in just a minute. But before we do, I want to put out this thought. In 2016, I was fascinated by the number of candidates that came through on the Republican side. And when Donald Trump ended up being the nominee, I thought to myself, wow. But when Hillary Clinton came through and then we saw Bernie Sanders, I thought, holy cow, we've got like two candidates that could actually potentially lose to Donald Trump, and then it happened. So this is my question is, was there a mistake in the process? Did the Democrats get who they wanted? And is there someone that they can consolidate support and get behind that could actually beat Donald Trump? Because in my opinion, I was like, man, two people came through that were the only two people maybe on the face of the planet that could lose to him. Maybe that's an unpopular opinion among Republicans, but that's how I felt, right? I mean, so quick 30-second reaction to that, and then we'll move on to something else. Emily, what do you think?
I think that 2020 is going to be a very different situation from 2016. We've got a very different field. It's much more diverse. It's much more robust, and I think that we're going to come out with a candidate who can put up a really good fight against Donald Trump.
Interesting.
I don't think so. I'm excited to watch the battle throughout the Democrats to see who rises to the top. I will maintain that I don't think any of them stand a chance, though.
Okay, so shifting, this is an interesting question, but somewhat related, is especially because it's a young political show, right? Let's have some fun. is America ready to have this conversation that we're having about socialism? Like, this is a really interesting question to me, right? Because we're starting to have a lot of young people say socialism is the right way we should be going. We're a country that is industrialized. We are a leader in the economic world. Why are we not socialized? And then you have people who are like, ugh, stomach ache just hearing the word socialism, right? America was founded on a free market system. So are we there? Is that something that we could do? Eric, do you want to start on this? And then
sure.
We'll go Emily, since we flip-flopped that last time.
You know, that's a really hard question to answer because socialism is such a general topic. There are aspects to our society that are socialized. A lot of the services that we use on a day-to-day basis are socialized, and we've generally accepted them. I think when a lot of candidates start talking about, well, let's socialize healthcare or let's socialize education, which a portion of our education is already socialized, but let's talk about free education, maybe free college education. That's a really easy ticket to sell young voters, right? Because it's easy enough to say, hey, we're going to give you your education for free. I don't think there's any weight behind it. I don't think there's an accurate way to actually pull it off. And I think that's vindicative of socialism in general. So I'm going to maintain that no, I don't think we are ready for it because I don't think it completely exists.
Okay. Emily.
I think we're definitely ready for this conversation. I think the idea of democratic socialism is something that's taking hold within young people in America simply because young people realize that when you don't have a free market choice in certain services, there can't be adequate prices attributed to them. And you can't have a market that actually exists. Something like healthcare. If I have a heart attack, I don't get to choose where I go to have that care, whether it's in market or out of market. And we realize that by socializing these kinds of services, we can create something that serves more people, reduces costs, allows for bargaining on prescription drugs, and will create a better system for everyone. I think what people have to realize is that just because you create a socialized option doesn't mean that private options go away. We still have private schools. We still will have every country that has socialized medicine still has private healthcare. And so I think that we're just young Americans are shifting how they perceive these things. Now, I will agree that there's a lot of, you know, plans out there. There's a lot of things being said. And I think that whoever is going to reach people from a democratic perspective has to be able to articulate it in a way where it's not just, you know, some fairy dust magical solution. It has to be something that's actually attainable.
I like that. We're looking for the non-Tinkerbell candidate, right?
Yes,
that's throwing
please.
Around fairy dust. Okay, so I want to talk about money. Money, 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 money. So there was a report recently that criticized slush funds used by Congress. Let's take, for example, Jason Chaffetz. He left Congress in June 2017. He's now a Fox News contributor, but he donated about 22% of the $102,000 leadership PAC money to candidates and political groups. But in the last 3 months of 2018, he spent money on things like airfare, $1,200 at Costco, $2,800 at the Trump International Hotel in Washington. He was quoted as saying, you know, there are limitations on what you can use it for. I use mine only for political purposes. But I think there's a lot of distrust that, you know, you have PACs like this that should only be for political purposes, buying things like airfare, right? So let's talk about that for just a minute or two. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, these leadership PACs do have a place in politics. They do have a place in the way our Congress is structured, really in the House of Representatives. But there has been a lot of misuse that I think is now coming to light. And I would like to see the FEC kind of step in a little bit and maybe, you know, reel that back in a little bit. I mean, even the notion of impropriety is going to poison the whole well. you know, there are people, there are elected officials using these leadership PACs in a responsible manner, but the small number of people that aren't are ruining it for everyone else.
These fat cats in Washington buying plane tickets, right? Emily, what are you going
to
say?
Yeah, I totally agree. There has to be more oversight on these. I mean, we've had this conversation over the last week with the controversy over the bill to raise the pay of members of Congress, and that has been now kind of shot down. It's not going anywhere. But I think that this is indicative of, you know, the need of people who are serving in Washington. And you know, to use a pack like this for things that aren't actually personal, like you said, even the appearance of impropriety, it destroys public trust. You know, like Orrin Hatch spent $7,000 on L.L. Bean apparel. Like, what political purpose did that serve? And so I think that looking into these things and asking that these politicians pay this back is probably the best route.
You got to look good in those L.L. Bean vests. I would like to see, you know, as we wrap up this segment, I would like to see education on what PACs are for, right?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, people see what happens with them because there is a place, but they get mad. But wait a minute, there is a place, right? Yeah. So maybe that's something we could talk about in the future. Anyway, stay with us. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. We got Eric Rowan on the right, and we have Emily on the left. She's killing it for us. Stay with us, and we're going to talk about some local stuff when we come back.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
On the left, I'm Emily Hayes.
And I'm Eric Rohn on the right.
And I'm Matt Lusty, right down the middle. And we just left talking about some national news, so we want to bring it home. We want to talk about some local stuff. You know, Salt Lake County recently passed an immigration resolution. It replaced a version that was originally sponsored by Councilwoman Shireen Gorbani, and it received unanimous approval Tuesday following a spirited, sometimes contentious debate among the partisan council, and only after members compromised on several changes recommended by Councilman Steve DeBry. So this conversation happened, debate happened, and at the end of the day, they reached this resolution. Emily, why don't you talk a little bit about what the resolution is, what it does, and then I want to ask, are resolutions important, right? I mean, and if they are, why are they? And if they're not, why aren't they?
So at its base, the resolution expresses that Salt Lake County is a place that is welcoming and open to immigrants. Shireen Gorbani is a daughter of immigrants, and so I believe that it was very close to her heart to pass something like this. A lot of the debate was around including whether or not to define the support for immigrants coming to the country legally, which was what was trying to be put in by some of her Republican council members. And I believe that it was in the end that the resolution got to where it needed to be. I think resolutions can be important. I think we all have seen resolutions that aren't really relevant to the body in which it's being passed. But I think that this is one where it is really relevant. These individuals represent over 1 million people in Salt Lake County. And I think that establishing the Salt Lake County government and our community as a place that is open and welcoming to immigrants is a very important thing.
Yeah, we can talk about housing affordability and where these folks would go because no one can buy a home right now. But that's a conversation for another time. Let's talk about whether or not, you know, Emily brought up a great point that this sets a standard, right? It kind of sets a tone with this resolution. What do you think, Eric? Our resolutions are important. Is it just fluff or is it like something that really makes a difference?
Yeah, I think a lot of resolutions are fluff. I completely agree with Emily that they do send a message. They do kind of set a standard. But personally, I like to see our elected officials actually take action, you know, demonstrate the message they're trying to send in these resolutions by acting on the promises they're making. You made a great point with the affordable housing. There is a housing crisis right now. Salt Lake has always been very accepting of refugees. We've seen a large increase in that population coming up. But what are we doing to help those individuals, not only the refugees, but the immigrants coming in as well? I've never been a big fan of resolutions, but I'm happy they got this one through.
Yeah, it's one of those things. Eric, I kind of tend to agree with you in that let me back up. I think sending a message is really important. But I will say in Utah and in Salt Lake County and Salt Lake City specifically, I feel like I've heard the immigration resolution message so many times. We had the Utah Compact. We had, you know, welcoming city here in Salt Lake. And now we, and don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that it's not a good thing to say we're welcoming. I think we should say we're welcoming all the time. But are there concrete steps we can be taking, right? Now, I know there are concrete steps that are happening. But the question to me is, if there's no actual mechanism tied to this, right? If there's no actual mechanism tied to I mean, it wouldn't be a resolution if you put a mechanism to it, mm-hmm. but an actual mechanism tied to this resolution, you know, what else is it doing besides generating press that says, hey, we're welcoming, which we've told everyone five times in the last 5 years anyway. What do you say, Emily? Am I crazy saying that?
I mean, I don't think you're crazy. I think that we have a kind of a culture here of being welcoming to people who are different, who are diverse, who are from different places, because, I mean, the city was founded by essentially religious refugees. And
right,
so
totally.
I think we have a very kind of ingrained culture of kind of reiterating this. And it might seem like you're, you know, kind of hitting the nail a few many times, but I think that it's something that's important to the people who live here. And I think it's also important to bring forward the sentiments of our elected officials. I mean, we had sitting county councilmen who were trying to change the definition to welcoming people that were coming to the country legally, when at the same time there have been reported plans by the Trump administration to send people who have been admitted to the country, quote, illegally, to other cities apart from the border. And so if we're going to be consistent in what we're holding, you know, if the Republican Party is going to be consistent, then we need to be accepting of everyone in these communities to make sure that we have a place for them.
I can see Eric getting ready to jump in on that.
Yeah, I tend to agree. It's a good chance for them to make statements that they can use in their campaigns later.
Right. Okay.
What's really funny to see during these resolutions is you do start to see them divide along party lines, where you have Steve DeBry saying, "Okay, I really want to stick. This is a crux for me." Right. That was his quote. The termage of legal. This is a crux for me. This is a hill I'm going to die on, because it falls within the party lines. And then on the left side, you have you have them saying, you know, we need to send a clearer message of welcoming to all people. And that falls on those lines. But it's a good chance for them to get out some good campaign slogans.
Sure. You know, Emily, you brought up a really good point, though, when you brought up the Trump administration. Because to me, immigration is such an interesting issue, because more has to be done on the national level. And it's frustrating to me to see that there are a lot of common sense things that could happen, right? Skilled visas, H-1B visas, everyone agrees that there should be more of those. We should not be turning away engineers to the U.S. economy just because they're from a different country. If they have the skills and they can come here and they can get the work done and they're going through a process that is legal through obtaining that visa, awesome, let them in. Why is that number capped, right?
Absolutely.
But because people tie it to ideologies, right, Eric, you brought up die on the hill, because people tie it to these strict ideologies, there's a lot of stuff that is common sense that's just not getting done, and that really irks me. That's something that's like, come on, guys, we could do this.
Yeah, so. Well, and the Trump administration had two full years where they could have passed immigration reform, and they didn't. So,
how long has Congress had the chance to do it?
That's the question for me, right? Is whether it's on the left or on the right, Congress has had an opportunity to address this
for a long time. Both sides have dropped the ball on this issue, and I hope to see, now that the Democrats control Congress, I hope to see them shift this a little bit. But we'll see.
Yeah. Although I agree, that was a good 1-2 punch that you could get in there, Emily, on the Trump administration. But I'm with the Congress. Side on that. I tend to agree with that. I want to shift topics here a little bit. We are in 2019, but that doesn't mean that there aren't campaigns happening, especially on the local level. We see in the Salt Lake City mayor's race, and people are gearing up for 2020 in the larger races. We've got congressional races, gubernatorial races that people are getting ready for. But since we've been talking about Salt Lake County, let's shift to Salt Lake City and talk about the Salt Lake City mayor's race. We just talked about a ton of candidates for the Democratic primary for president. Now we're going to talk about a ton of candidates in the nonpartisan. You guys can't see, but I'm doing air quotes here for the nonpartisan race for Salt Lake mayor. I guess it is nonpartisan because everyone there, I think, is running on Democratic values, Democratic platform. What are we going to do with this, Emily? You're the insider here for the Democratic side. What's going to happen in Salt Lake City?
I think we've got some real heavy hitters running this year. As we know, we've got Luz Escamilla, who is a current sitting senator. We have former Senator Jim DeBacchus. We have sitting city councilwoman Erin Mendenhall, former city councilman Stan Penfold. I mean, we've got an incredible field this year, and it's feeling a little bit like the National Democratic primary as well. where it seems like everyone is running. And I think that since Mayor Biskupski announced that she was no longer seeking a second term, it kind of opened the floodgates, so to speak, and brought a lot more kind of talent into the field. So it's going to be really interesting to see what comes out of it. The Salt Lake City mayor's race is always really kind of interesting to watch because it's generally the most high-profile municipal election whenever it's up in the county. And it's, you know, we're going to have a Democrat in that seat. So it's a kind of our safe bet as the party. And we don't really take sides, but we feel good knowing that Salt Lake City is going to have great leadership going forward.
Yeah. So Eric, kind of your thoughts, what do you look for, understanding that this is a Democrat seat? Generally, once again, my air quotes for nonpartisan, yeah. But even though, you know, it's really going to be a Democrat that takes the seat, what do you look for, right? What do you want in the person that takes that seat? Because the person that sits as mayor of Salt Lake City has a critical role in communicating with the legislature. They've got a national platform, really, as being the capital mayor, the largest city in Utah's mayor. They're at a lot of events with the Association of Mayors, different things like that. Mm-hmm. What do you want to see in that person?
Well, as I start to see Mayor Biskupski, you know, kind of edge her way out, I want to see a mayor who's active, because we didn't get that from her. I want to see someone who understands the role that the city plays more as a business instead of a government. We have some major issues right now in terms of housing, the homeless populations, development of different areas. And then, like you said, negotiating with the state legislature as well. So they need to understand those negotiating factors. They need to understand the way the economy is going to work. But one who is also active in the community, who can go and connect with the people. I didn't see that from Mayor Biskupski, but I hope to see that from someone moving in.
Sure. Okay, that's a great point. Now, because of the race to the Salt Lake City mayor, you're having a lot of Democratic candidates not jump in for governor, right? And there might be some, I don't want to call it trauma, but because of what happened with Mike Weinholz, who was really a good candidate, is what most people thought. But just, we live in a red state, right? We live in a Republican state. So you don't have a lot of Democrats jumping in. Is there going to be a Democrat that jumps in for governor? And what about the Republican names that are swirling around? We've got, you know, a lot of names being talked about as to running for governor. So why don't we start there? Let's start with Democrats not jumping in or jumping in, and then let's talk about Republicans. Emily, what do you see on that front?
I think we'll start to see Democrats jumping into the gubernatorial race here in the next few months. You're right, this is a red state, but the demographics of Utah are shifting, particularly in Salt Lake County. We have a lot more kind of a blue tint to us, as we've seen after the 2018 elections. And so I'm really hoping that we'll get someone who's a really heavy hitter. I think we've heard a couple names floating around. Can't really reveal anything as a, you know, the party chair. I think we'll have a really good person jumping in there to run against whoever the Republican is.
Interesting. Eric, are Republicans even thinking about Democrats in this race?
Not at all.
Even worried. Okay. No. kind of like Democrats aren't worried about Republicans jumping in Salt Lake City, but okay, yeah. Go ahead. Tell me why they're not worried about that.
Well, I mean, when you have such a red state, you're going to have a wider divide within your party than between the parties. And so when we look at the candidates, the Republican candidates that are throwing their names in the ring, the real battle is in the primary, not in the general. We've had names like, Lieutenant Governor Cox has announced now. We expect former House Speaker Hughes to announce towards the end or towards fall. Chaffetz was mulling over the idea. I don't think that's going to pan out. I think he's focused a little bit more on pandering to Trump on Fox. And now there's the question of John Huntsman, former Governor John Huntsman, throwing his hat in the ring. And to me, that is a fascinating question.
Yeah, you're going to have a lot of, you know, Emily used the term heavy hitters. I think you're going to be seeing a lot of heavy hitters on the Republican side jump in. It's going to be competitive. Well, we have just a couple of minutes. I think we're going to have to stop there. I want to talk about gripes because that's one of my favorite parts of the show. We get to talk about what is just killing us recently. So I'm going to start because this gripe can be anything, and it doesn't have to be anything. My gripe is that speaking about housing, my wife and I are building a house right now. We're really excited. I've been living in my in-laws' basement, walkout basement, for the last 6 months after we sold our home. And so my gripe is that it just can't magically be ready. Why can't that house just like walk in? That might help with housing affordability if we could just snap our fingers and then boom, houses are done. But Man, I'm telling you, I'm ready to get out of the basement and enjoy the summer sun. Eric, do you have a gripe?
I do, and it actually kind of aligns a little bit with that. Construction. It is construction season here in Utah, and it is bugging me.
Sitting in the car.
I love to see infrastructure happening. I love to see it get better. But man, traffic is killing me. I'm ready for construction season to be over.
Okay. Emily, what's your gripe? What are you feeling?
Mine is also related. So I just bought a house.
Okay, great.
It's a duplex, and I'm trying to get a contractor out to do some work. And it has been absolutely impossible to get a contractor.
Oh, contractors are hard right now.
They are just swamped. And so if you're a contractor out there, please come find me.
You're hearing the play on the show from plug. Emily. That is wonderful. Hey, you have been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. We've really enjoyed this Young Politicos discussion. We have a fantastic producer here in Anthony Scoma who's doing wonderful work for us. And we've been joined today by Emily Hayes on the left, Eric Rowan on the right, and I'm Matt Lusty filling in the political middle. Thanks for listening. Send us a comment and keep listening, please, to KCPW. Thanks very much and have a good day.